Welcome to the Bikepack Adventures Podcast. I am your host, Chris Panaski. This podcast was created so as to share the stories of bike tours, bike packers, and endurance racers from around the world as they embark on amazing adventures. Through their stories, you'll be able to learn the ins and outs of bike travel. You'll get insight into various countries and cultures, hear fantastic stories of their journeys, and through both mine and my guests' experiences, you'll learn about the pros and cons of specific gear, bikes, and bike setups. If you're new to bike travel and considering going on an adventure, I hope the podcast provides you with that extra little bit of motivation to make it happen. The Bikepack Adventures Podcast is proudly supported by Panorama Cycles, Redshift Sports, Tailfin Bikepacking Equipment, Race Day Fuel, and Full Cycle Ottawa. Their continued support allows me to focus my efforts on providing you amazing content. Now back to the show.
Hey everyone, welcome back to the Bikepack Adventures Podcast. In this episode of the podcast, we are sharing the story of a very personal journey, a two-week family trip through Northern France, Belgium, and the Netherlands. Joined by my wife, who is taking on her first loaded bike tour, and our young daughter, we set out to explore the coastal charm, rich culture, and world-class cycling infrastructure of Northern France, Belgium, and the Netherlands. Over the course of this episode, we'll walk you through the planning, gear choices, and daily rhythms of traveling as a family by bike. We'll reflect on what it's like to parent on the move, how we kept our child engaged, and how we adjusted our pace to match the needs of the entire crew. Along the way, we discovered vibrant cities like Bruges, Den Haag, Breda, Antwerp, and Ghent, stumbled into memorable meals, and met locals who remind us of why bike touring is such a powerful way to connect with the world. Whether you're planning your first family tour or just curious about what it's like to ride with a toddler in tow, this episode is packed with insights, stories, and a few laughs from the road.
The Bikepack Adventures Podcast is supported by some pretty rad companies. A couple of them are Panorama Cycles and Full Cycle Ottawa. The new Panorama Katadin 2.1 is a gravel rig tuned for long-haul comfort and wild terrain. Built with lighter tubing and progressive geometry, the frame has also been tested to full mountain bike standards for durability and peace of mind, even when the trail disappears and the terrain gets rowdy. With integrated mounts, generous tire clearance, and reliability-first components, it's the bike packer's dream machine. Roll deeper, explore wilder, ride the Katadin 2.1. On gravel roads or cruising through city streets, Full Cycle Ottawa has been your trusted ride companion for over 30 years. Locally rooted and rider-approved, they stock top-tier bikes from legendary brands like Norco, Cannondale, Cervelo, and distribute Panorama Cycles. From expert service to cutting-edge gear, Full Cycle keeps your wheels turning. Ready to roll? Swing by today. Your next adventure starts at Full Cycle Ottawa.
Seema, welcome back to the podcast. It's been a long 6 years.
Hi, thanks for having me. I've been listening. I've been a supporter of Patreon for 6 years, but I'm finally in the podcast. I interviewed Mariam in 2019. That was the last time I was in the podcast. Mariam is originally from Iran. She's living in Mexico now in Ensenada. She was bikepacking in Cambodia, and we were living in with her
soon-to-be husband.
Now it's her husband. And now she has her own YouTube video called La Vida de Mariam. She shows her life in Mexico, and they're very interesting, actually. If you're interested in learning more about the country, check her YouTube out. It's in Persian and Spanish.
Neither of which I speak. We are back, and we did a pretty amazing trip. We got back around 3 weeks ago, I think. And we first recorded this episode about a week ago and unfortunately had a complete meltdown of our house internet with literal component breaking or something. And Bell had to come fix it. So we are now re-recording because it couldn't save. This summer it was pretty interesting the way things worked out. We had plans. They fell through. And I quickly got online and started to figure out what kind of flights I could find to Europe. We had this idea about a year ago was to do a bike tour. Initially, I thought, you know, Stockholm down to Belgium where we had some friends. And that was all kind of changing. And it made more sense just to find the cheapest tickets and make your own adventure through that. You want to add some details, sweetheart?
Yes. So So Chris is a teacher. He only has the summers to travel. And unfortunately, teachers can't take time off during the school year. So we've always talked about bike touring in Europe, but I was always nervous because Jasmine was very young. And very recently we talked about one of us would plan a summer. So this year, 2025, was Chris's time to plan the summer. 2026, next year, is my time. And as Chris said, we had other plans that they fell through and they fell off. And very last minute, we're like, oh, we only have 1 month left in the summer, or Chris is a school break. Let's plan something. So Chris sat in front of his computer and found a cheap flight from Ottawa to London, direct flight with Air Canada. And it was how much? Very cheap.
About $400 a person.
$400 per person. And Jasmine, when we did this bikepacking, was 3.5 years old. So three of us flew to London. I have a best friend living in London. Her name is Shadi. We stayed with her for a week.
About 8 days.
8 days. And we didn't do any biking. So we just did sightseeing, met with friends, and
it
had fun.
Really, a really, really phenomenal week in London. I personally had a chance to meet up with my buddy Michael, who he's from Ireland, and we used to live in Russia at the same time, and I hadn't seen him in 17 years. And he just so happened to be in London for a wedding that weekend. So I had a chance to meet with him. And another really good buddy of mine, John. And John and I was at his wedding maybe 10 or 11 years ago. And this time we got to hang out with him and his wife and his daughters, and they took us sightseeing. And then another day we met up with him and did lunch, and yeah, it was really great.
Yeah, we met friends Wayne and Nina in London, met up with my Iranian friends Fatema and Arash. It was just a very good week.
Very packed week.
Very packed, but very interesting, very fun. And then from London, we took a train to Dover.
Yeah.
And then we, from Dover's train station, we rode our bicycles to the ferry.
Yeah.
Where we took the ferry to Dunkirk in north of France. And we really started our bike touring from Dunkirk. So we went north of France to Belgium and Netherlands, and then from Netherlands to Belgium, and we stopped at Ghent. And from Ghent, we took a train to Lille in France, and then another train from Lille to Paris. And yeah, we stopped in Paris. We flew back, direct flight from Paris.
Luckily, we were flying Air Transat and not Air Canada, because they had a work stoppage right at that time, and there was a lot of stress going on with everybody we knew that happened to be traveling at the time.
Yeah, we were lucky.
So when I said earlier that it was Seema's first loaded tour, I mean, we had done some loaded overnighters where she's had her e-bike, or and we did also the Pitsi Tanzanar, which is a 200-kilometer route, when Jasmine was 6 months old. But on that one, we were all unloaded. We had I would just race back every day and pick up the SUV with the little mini caravan trailer. And so this was Seema's first time carrying luggage. And the idea
Not
of...
Not first time carrying luggage.
Sorry, carrying luggage.
On a
luggage,
regular bike.
Yeah, carrying luggage on a normal bike for multiple days. And the idea behind this route was that it would connect to friends, but also is a... some countries with really good bike infrastructure and very flat. So the only thing I had to worry about was wind. So that was kind of the idea with the route. At first I thought we should cycle to Paris, but then Seema said, well, you know, is there a way we could go to Netherlands? I have a really good friend, and I know her as well, Mojgan, and her husband Ali. And she said, if we can go up to Netherlands, we can visit my friends and do some sightseeing with them. And so we just modified. And I think this was all planned within about 10 days of departure. So
yeah, I messaged Shadi and said, are you around? And this is summer when people always plan things ahead. I said, are you around if Chris and Jasmine and I come to London? And she called me. She was so thrilled. She was like, yeah, come. Early August, it was her son's first birthday too that we were in London. We celebrated together. And then I messaged Mojgan. I didn't even know which city in Netherlands she She lives, and I said, like, are you around if I come to Netherlands? And then she called me. She was super excited, and I realized she actually lives in Den Haag. And
that is the Hague for all English speakers. Yeah.
And then she took 3 days off work while we were there. Yeah. So it was just very exciting to see, like, friends are available and we could connect with them. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then we had other friends. So as she mentioned, Wayne and Nina, they had them and their kids were just in the process of leaving Antwerp and moving to Slovakia. So they just happened to be in London. So we spent a day with them there. But at the same time, one of my old coworkers from Malaysia was recruited by Wayne to work at the international school. So we had a chance to see Matt in Antwerp as well. So really, like, everywhere we went, it felt like we were visiting friends that we hadn't seen in years, or in the case of Mojgan, we had seen her within a year or two.
We met up with our friend's daughter Middelburg in Netherlands. To me, when I travel, like, cycling to me is just a vehicle to get to places, but the fact that I can meet up with friends that I haven't met or family I haven't met for a while, that's more exciting than cycling, personally. So the highlights were really meeting up with Jordi in Middelburg, Matt in Antwerp, Mojgan in Den Haag, Shadi, Fatima, Arash, and your friend.
Yeah, Matt, and you had a lot of friends in London that we saw.
Like, yeah, multiple friends in Wayne, Nina. Yeah, too many to count.
Yeah. So let's jump into the bikes. This is the interesting part. When we planned it originally, I was, and it has nothing to do about the size of the luggage and stuff, because as an ex-military member, I do get free luggage on most Canadian airlines. So just take some planning of your flights to make sure that you're flying on a Canadian airline. Actually, I think I get free luggage on American Airlines as well as a ex-service member. But I thought if we brought the folding bikes, it would make more sense, because I knew we'd be mixing in some trains and some buses and subways and whatnot. And the idea there would be, it would just be easier if we had to fold them up or pack them down. We could just do that. I think overall it was a good decision. But on this trip, maybe not really necessary. Maybe our gravel bikes would have been more comfortable, faster. Just an all-around better ride, and the infrastructure was much better than I had anticipated, so it probably wasn't really necessary to bring the folded bikes. But I could see how the folded bikes could be really advantageous if we go bike touring in some other places in the future. Our setup was very traditional. I had my Bike Friday New World Tourist. It's a steel folding bike that's made to feel like kind of a normal bike, and it has racks on the front and back. So I had some Tailfin panniers that Tailfin hooked us up with when I went to see them while we were in London. Took a train to Bath, or sorry, a bus to Bath, cycled to Bristol, visited them, had a tour of the operations there, cycled back to Bath, and just a really, really great day on the bike. With the bags that we needed that were slightly larger than what I already had. And so we packed those up, and that was our trip bags. I had two 16-liter bags on the back of my bike, two 10-liters on the front. Seema had the Tailfin rack on her folding bike, which was a little high and made it all a little bit more wobbly than it needed to be, which she can tell you a really funny story about after. And on the back, she had two 16-liter bags and the AT20. It's an 18 liter top rack top bag. So yeah, funny story time leaving.
So I know when people start, they want to go on a bike tour, they usually rehearse with their bags before they
test
travel,
ride, test shake, ride, shake down ride. Yeah.
Shake down, whatever it's called. But I was working long hours before our trip because I had to make sure that I take care of my projects. I do project management before taking almost 3 weeks vacation. So by the time I was done working, I was too tired to pack a bag and test ride. So one night before we left Ottawa, I packed and... I never rode it. And I actually had not ridden my folding bike for many years too, because
it had been broken.
It was broken, and Chris very recently fixed it. And since it was fixed, I hadn't really had a chance to ride it, but I had this amazing electronic shifting that I didn't.
She had a Shimano Alphine Di2 internal hub. So yeah, I mean, it's super, super sweet.
So, but I did, I had no chance or time to ride it before the trip. And we went to London, we stayed with Shadi for 8 days. And then from Shadi's home, we started riding to the train station.
Yeah.
So Chris put all the bags that I was supposed to take with me on my bike. And all my weight was in the back. Yeah? So mm-hmm. I had no front panniers.
The front end is very light on that bike.
And then the rack was too high. And as he said, it made my bike wobbly. And I started riding. Everything was like, you know, when you're on a boat and you're like wobbling. Mm-hmm. Like it was that kind of feeling. And then Shadi, my friend, got worried. I was like, Sima, are you sure you can do this? I was like, I don't know. And then, you know, like how little kids, they're trying to train and learn.
All over the road.
The parents hold the back of the bike so they can balance. And then they ride. And then after a while, the parents leave, they like take their hand off and then they just go. It was like that. So Shadi was holding the back of my bike and I was riding. She was like, you okay? You can balance? I was like, I think so. Let go of your hand. And then like I rode, but it was very difficult because it was the first time I'm riding that bike with all the bags. And then we go to the streets and to get to the train station. And London roads are very narrow. And they're like these buses.
Yeah, you were very slow and nervous.
I was very nervous. But then I got used to it. Like, I'm always like that. Like, for me, the start is always difficult. But then after that, like, my...
And I think that was, like, getting from Shadi's house to St. Pancras International Station to catch the train to Dover was probably the hardest transiting we did on the entire trip.
Yeah.
Frustrating. It was just elevators and, like, one bike at a time. Or I'd take the two bikes and then Sima would push the chariot, which was being pulled behind my bike, which I had to disconnect each time. So frustrating. We literally, the last train to get to the train station, we almost missed it. And I think if we had to miss that train, we would have missed our train because we got there about 4 minutes before
that. So I think we had planned to be there 1 hour earlier.
30 or 40 minutes earlier.
But we got there 7 minutes earlier because... their elevators are old. They call them lift in UK. So they're old. They were lucky that at least there was an elevator. Many of their train stations have only stairs.
So that's why I planned it with the train from Shadi's, because I knew if we took the train.
Yeah, we could actually check if those stations have elevator or not. But because they're old, they're also built small. So they don't fit two folding bikes and the chariot and three of us. So we had to take multiple trips, and that really took a long time.
Yeah, really, really delayed things. But anyways, we made it. And it was fantastic, you know. I don't know what else to say about that. Yeah, Jasmine was in a chariot. It was like, you know, like the Thule chariots, but the old versions that were sold by a Canadian company before Thule bought them. And she was really good in there. As Sima mentioned, her bike had a electronic shifting of an internal hub. Mine with the And also the nice thing about the Birdie is it has a elastomer suspension at the back and front of the bike. So it's got a little bit of suspension and, you know, like if you hit bumps, there's some absorption there. The Bike Friday doesn't. So on mine, the last few years, I've been running it with a Redshift seat post and a stem as well. So it just kind of absorbs all those little shocks and bumps from small wheels hitting big things. And on top of that, I had a B17 Brooks saddle on my bike. And we carried all the normal tools that you would carry on any bike trip, you know, some spare shifting cables. Not that I figured I would need any for her. Spare shifting cables, spare nuts and bolts and some, you know, multi-tools and pumps and stuff like that. No real breakdowns except the little latch on the back of Sima's Birdie. in transit from Canada. It must have got jammed against something and broke. So I had to zip tie the rear swing arm in place. So it would just stayed as a non-folding bike for the back half, but that worked really well. And yeah, thank God, because I didn't know what I would do otherwise.
You had a pedal problem that you needed an Allen key.
Well, I did have one problem later on. Yeah, one of my crank was actually coming loose, and I didn't have a big enough Allen key to tighten the cap. So once you tighten the crank on, I could do that. I couldn't get the cap tight enough to stop the inner bolt from coming loose. So we saw a farm, and this was probably on day 6 or 7. It was on the way to Antwerp. So day 7 of our riding. So it was one of the last days. And I saw a farm, and the lady was in there. I saw a lady in the barn area and full of tools, like the workshop. So I just pulled in there and asked her if she had an Allen key. She had no idea what I was talking about, but said, come on in. She thought I was talking about a socket because, you know, English, Belgian, Flemish, different languages. But when I saw the Allen keys on the bench, I grabbed those, and sure enough, they were metric because it's Europe and they fit. So I fixed it. And I think she was surprised that I needed such a tool for such a simple fix and that it was good enough.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was just about the only mechanical issue. We had no flats, nothing else. Yeah. Let's talk about packing and preparation. Anything that you packed that you wish you hadn't have packed?
For me, the rain pants. Rain doesn't bother me. We never used it. We were lucky that it didn't actually rain.
It never
rained
when
we were riding. But I don't think even if it rained, I would have put the rain pants on.
Yeah, it was something we didn't really need.
And rain jacket. I had a rain jacket and a sweater. Again, rain doesn't bother me. Getting wet doesn't bother me that much. But my rain jacket is very, very light too. So maybe I would have.
I think you wouldn't want to pass up on the rain jacket because if you happen to be stuck in rain for a whole day. But I know in your mind, you're like, well, we just wouldn't ride.
Yeah, I wouldn't ride.
And we would just take a bus or a train.
Yeah.
So probably maybe in this case, it wouldn't have been necessary because we probably would have just figured out some alternative means of transport. But we never had rain issues. And so, yeah, we really didn't need the rain pants. But the rain jackets, I still would have brought.
And for shoes, I had my Birkenstock sandals and my Keen sandals and the Nike shoes. I think between the Keen sandals and Nike shoes, I would have chosen just one.
What do you think you would have brought?
Probably the Nikes only because I had Birkenstock as sandals, mm-hmm. So I didn't need.
So they have like an actual footwear that's.
Yeah, the Nikes and but the problem is that I bought those Nikes a day or two before our trip, so I had not really used it that much. I thought they were comfortable. They had very good reviews online. But I knew my Keen sandals are very, very comfortable.
Right.
So I wanted to make sure that if the Nikes are not comfortable, I would just throw them out. I bought them for $70 or $60 on sale. And I was like, if it's too bad, I'll just throw it out. But I have my Keen sandals that I'm comfortable and I'm confident.
And were they okay?
They were okay. Yeah, they were okay. Yeah. My shoe size is small, so my shoes don't take so much space.
Yeah, like one pair, two pairs of your shoes are one of mine. Yeah.
And then... So the rain gears of one shoe and the other thing that I would have not taken was like makeup stuff. I think I took too much, too many lipsticks. Again, they don't take much space. They don't weigh that much, but I didn't use them when I was riding. I didn't really put any makeup except
the
sunscreen.
And when we get somewhere, you don't feel like it anyways.
Yeah, but like... I didn't need like 10 lipsticks. Probably were okay with 2 or 3. But
One or none.
Yeah. For Jasmine, we took some stuffed toys.
I didn't know anything Jasmine had planned, like packed other than clothes and then
she
other
stuff.
She packed
herself and then we went through it and actually made it less than what she packed. But she took some stuffed toys. they're bulky. They're still small. They're not like this big teddy bear.
They just take a lot of space in a bag.
But they take space, yeah. And she had too many tights. And she also had her Crocs, sandals, and one like sneakers.
But I have to say, maybe it was the day before we left, or maybe the morning of the day before. I went into the bedroom, and Jasmine's aunt and her grandma were helping her pack, and they had something like 20 pairs of underwear out. They had 20 pairs of socks out, and they're like, one for every day. And I was like, no. Like, the world has washing machines. We don't need that much stuff.
Especially in
so we got rid of a lot of that.
You're not traveling with a suitcase, you have to.
Yeah.
But we got rid of some of Jasmine's clothes in Den Haag when we met up with Mojgan. We donated them there was a UNICEF drop-off. And when we were in Middelburg in Netherlands, I put some of her clothes and one pair of shoes in the hotel, and I put a stack of paper and I wrote free on it, because she's growing very fast, and two pairs of her shoes weren't fitting her very well, and most of the time she was just wearing her Crocs.
Always.
So we got rid of her sneakers and got rid of her sandals, and because she was okay with her Crocs.
We actually asked her, "Do you want to give these away?" And she said, "Okay."
And but we got I would have taken less tights, shoes, and stuffed toys for Jasmine. Did you have anything that you would have not taken?
I didn't bring that much stuff. Not really sure. I mean, I had a pair of pants, a very light pair, and a long sleeve shirt that was very light, and I never, ever used them. But you never know. You know, if you had a really cold night, you wish you had them. So I'm glad I brought them. They didn't take much space. Essentially, I used one 16-liter bag for my stuff, one 16-liter bag for Jasmine's, and then the 10-liter ones on the front of my bike were for, like, one of them had, I don't know, some spare tubes and towels, like beach towels, like the small can, like, you know, travel towels. And the other one had the rain gear. So not a lot, like, and then Seema had her bags on her bike. She had her work laptop and mouse and these things as well, because she had to work half days the week we were in London, which was a real pain for her. But
yeah, definitely if I could, I would have not taken my laptop with me. I had this Telfin bag that has a sleeve for laptop.
Yeah, they did hook us up with that.
But Telfin. And it was like a full-size 14-inch laptop. It wasn't just a tablet that doesn't take so much space. I think next time if I really have
to... Could you go with your Surface tab?
No, I think now I'm thinking about it. If this happens again that I have to travel and take a work laptop, I'll ask my employer to set up my Surface laptop. A Surface tablet.
Oh, okay.
I can just take that. Yeah, I could have asked them to put tools on it and let me take that.
That would have been ideal. Traveling with a child. Let's jump into that topic. I think that interests a lot of people. I do hear about it at the Canadian Shield Bikepacking Summit. It's always one of those things people want to know more about. Jasmine is 3.5 years old, and she handled the journey really, really well. Like, it was quite unpredictable, but she loves being on a bike. So that is one of the really good things about this trip, is we know already she loves to travel. Like, she loves to be on the bike. She typically loves to be on the Mac ride, which is kind of like a kid's ride shotgun in front of me. But with the folding bikes, I couldn't bring that. So that was another downside to not bringing a bigger bike. And in some ways, I wish we could have brought full-size bikes. Then we could have brought that little seat, and she could have ridden in front with us and had a different experience too.
She saw these cargo bikes.
She saw the front.
And she kept saying, "Mama, when we go back to Canada, can you buy me these?"
Thank
bikes?
God she's forgotten about it, because
she really likes the cargo bikes.
Yeah, she sees the ones with the big baskets in the front, you know, where kids have seats and stuff, and they're all over the place there. And she saw them, and she really liked those. Anyways, can't afford it. She did learn one thing I think that was really beneficial on this trip that I've kind of mentioned to a lot of people when I talk about it, is she learned to be bored, you know? As a teacher, I think a lot of kids don't learn how to be bored these days. You get on the car trip, here's a tablet, here's a phone, here's a watch this movie, don't bug us. And so kids never have that opportunity to learn what boredom is. And on a trip like this, we couldn't always give her a device. And we rarely do anyways, but there was a couple days where we let her call her grandma to just give us some peace when she was really being cranky and bored and we were trying to get somewhere. But for the most part, it was, you know, playing word games and looking at things as we rode our bikes and singing songs. And then she would just entertain herself. At some point, she would just play with her food or play with her toys. She had little booklets with markers and she would just color in them. And I think that was really, really good. What are your thoughts?
I think we never started too early.
We always around checkout. So yeah, it was really late steps.
We would wake up, have our breakfast, take our time, check out from our hotel. And then we usually started around noon, right? And
then 11, 12.
Yeah. So by then, like, she already had like a morning with us. She had breakfast, she played and things like that. She doesn't watch cartoon generally on TV.
Sometimes in the hotel.
In the hotel, but like not on phone. So we never gave her our phones to watch cartoon. Like I'm not judging the parents that do that, but it's just that not us. Like
we don't have a TV upstairs in our house. So she's never grown into that habit of having a TV on. And she doesn't have an older sibling here with her, where like our friends that have kids her age, they have an older sibling that watches TV. They're like normal teenagers. And so they have this sense of like, this is something you do. But Jasmine doesn't have that.
Jasmine doesn't even know the cartoons out there, like Bluey, this, that. Like she only knows who Barbie is. And so we start around noon. And then by the time we start writing, it's almost lunchtime. So we would stop. We took many, many breaks. Whenever we saw these splashbacks, we had her mayo, she calls it, her swimsuit on top of the bag, so we could just open the bag and find the swimsuit easily.
As well as the towel.
And the towel. So we stop, we let her play in the splash pad, and then we have lunch. And then she gets very tired because she would play for an hour, sometimes hour and a half. And if we start riding, she would take small naps in the chariot. And then when she wakes up, we would probably stop again.
She usually wanted ice cream by then or something.
And the good thing in Europe is that like everything is accessible. There's like grocery stores, restaurants, ice cream shops.
And we talked about this recently. I think like we were saying that one of the biggest difference with Canada and somewhere like Belgium and Netherlands is Canada has really good bike infrastructure for leisure. You know, just for getting out there and going for a ride. But over there, their bike infrastructure is for living. It's you know, you could ride your bike to the grocery store. You know, you could ride it to the gas station. Like, why would you need to go there? Who knows? But everywhere is connected by bike, where here it's just along the rivers and along some canals or old train lines. And that's about it, which is great. Like, it's a good start, but it's definitely there's room for improvement here in Canada.
I should also say now I'm thinking about it is that maybe it was easier for us and Jasmine is because Jasmine knows how to play solo.
She's an only child, so.
And I think that's also her character. Like when her teacher gave us her report card last year, I remember she had written that Jasmine likes to play on her own. And it's not because she feels isolated or she's sad. She just enjoys being by herself. Mm-hmm. And she does that at daycare too. She has a couple of best friends.
She only plays with like two friends.
Yeah, and then if they're not around, she's very, very happy to play by herself. She plays very well with her best friends, but she somehow knows to entertain herself. So I guess that is something that we were lucky. So I would recommend to parents that they want to travel with toddler is that teach their kid like how to play by themselves, like do coloring or give them fidget toys.
Yeah. And I think a good part of that is like starting them off with you, you know, doing some Play-Doh and then saying, okay, keep playing and I'll be back. And like go and come back and like give them breaks where they're playing by themselves. And I don't know. I'm not sure if that's a solid theory, yeah. But.
And then Jasmine likes some snacks very much. Like Jasmine really loves fruits, like tangerines, croissants to grapes. So we kept buying those snacks for her too. And we had it in the little pocket in her chariot. So she was happy just eating her snacks, and she was entertained by eating those things. Yeah. We stopped in Amsterdam and bought her some Tony's chocolate. She was very happy to eat those little chocolate balls. They were like little chocolate balls, I think. That's what they're called. So
yeah, they were like chocolate with like caramels or whatever. Yeah. And I think for the most part, we had really no trouble with her. The biggest problems we had with Jasmine on the entire trip were actually when we weren't biking, days where we were not biking the next day, but we were, you know, with friends and stayed out really late. And, you know, the next day she just woke up really, really overly tired. You know, we went to bed like 1 a.m. and she probably didn't fall asleep till like 12 something when we were on the train. And basically just made the next day a living hell for us. But, you know, it was out of her control. It was our own fault. So we learned the hard way. I think by this time it happened the second time is where I clued into what exactly why she's behaving the way she is. And we had a little talk about it and we're like, okay, let's not replicate that. So when we reached Antwerp actually, and we went to the bar with Matt and Jasmine was there, she was tired around 10 something. We were also tired. We'd cycled a big day and we decided, okay, it's a good time to go back to the hotel and we'd just catch up the next day. So we had to be responsible parents.
Yeah, but there were many nights that she slept late. Also, like she doesn't have a proper nap. Yeah. Like she at home at daycare, I think they nap for 1.5 hours at least. When she's home, she even naps longer in the afternoon. But in the chariot, it wasn't that comfortable for her.
We should add that like Jasmine does not have a normal routines like. I feel like a lot of Canadian kids, they're in bed at, you know, her age or like 7, 7:30. And Jasmine almost never goes to bed. I don't think we usually have even eaten by 7, 7:30. So
yeah,
she has snacks after school and then we have supper at like 7:30.
She also sleeps with one of us or my mom next to her. She's not that kind of toddler that goes to bed on her own.
But she sleeps well. She wakes up not cranky unless you go to bed at midnight.
Yeah, but also I think one of the reasons that we were not having a lot of challenges during this tour was we have done this before with her. It wasn't her first time. Like we've done overnighter. She had slept in the tent before.
Yeah.
And she goes to daycare with Chris in her chariot.
Sometimes.
We have done like weekend travel together in her chariot. But we have also done like things around Ottawa area. So we just say, Jasmine, you want to go for a bike ride? She says, yes.
Yeah, we went to some of the beaches. She could play in the sand.
So she definitely had practice. Like I would not recommend people to just put their kids in the chariot and travel internationally bike touring for a kid that never been in a chariot.
Yeah, it's definitely something you have to work up to.
Yeah, definitely like do quick ones, like start from taking them to school. And then take them for 1 hour, 2 hours rides and build it from there. Because as much as you want it to be fun for you as parents, it has to be fun for the kid too.
Yeah. And what were some of the challenges we faced traveling with kids in these foreign countries, especially Belgium and Netherlands and France? Yeah, toilets.
I'd like to take a moment to thank a couple more sponsors of the Bikepack Adventures podcast. Redshift Sports was founded in 2013 by a team of mechanical engineers who also happen to be avid cyclists. From the beginning, they focused on taking a different approach to product development, drawing on their own experiences and needs to create components that make a meaningful difference to the riding experience. The highly popular Shock Stop suspension system smooths out road imperfections, reducing fatigue and strain. You can check them out at redshiftsports.com or follow the affiliate link down in the show notes to help sustain the podcast. Use the promo code BPA15 to save 15% at checkout. Tailvin Cycling, designer of technical bikepacking equipment, has been creating waves in the cycling community for several years, having stepped outside the conventional boundaries of bikepacking equipment to find unique solutions that make the adventure all the better. Whether an endurance racer, bike tour, or bikepacker, these bags offer solutions for everyone. From their unique rear rack with quick release mechanism to their ingenious locking mechanism on their panniers that provide a rattle-free biking experience, Tailfin continues to push the envelope. I'm extremely pleased to have them supporting the podcast and to represent them on all my adventures.
What a pain.
Yeah, so we're very spoiled in Canada that we have public bathroom access everywhere. Like, was it yesterday? I went to Old Navy, which is like a clothing brand in Canada and US. Even Old Navy has bathroom. It has like kids changing table, a water fountain for drinking water.
And they're free.
And they're all free. Like, we have clothing stores, like a home... goods like home appliances, they all have bathrooms. Mm-hmm. Walmart, grocery stores, but in Netherlands, there and Belgium, they weren't
and
accessible.
France.
And France, and if they were, they were not free.
Yeah.
So you pay €1, €1.50, sometimes
I think
€2.
€2 was the one France, in Champs-Élysées. Oh man, $3 just to go for a pee.
And
when you have a little kid, and they're like, "I need to go pee," and you got to pay $3, and you get in there, and they go, "I don't have to pee anymore."
Yeah.
Like,
no.
Oh, shit.
10 minutes later,
so
she has to pee. And it was when we got to Den Haag, my friend Morgan actually told me about that. Like she said, like, Sima, this is a big problem. I remember in Bruges, I had to go to the bathroom and it would only accept coin and we didn't have cash with us. We only had credit cards, so I couldn't go to the bathroom. And luckily it was me. It wasn't Jasmine. Like, what would I have done if...
Yeah,
it was Jasmine.
I already just
train
over.
Stations, their bathrooms are not even clean, but you pay €1, €1.50, and people line up because train stations are very busy.
Yeah.
And it's just it's not a dirty toilet, but it's not a super clean, shiny toilet too. And yeah, that definitely, sometimes when Jasmine said Mamaya had to pee, we had to stop at a cafe, but we had to like buy a coffee or something. So we could use their bathroom.
Yeah. And the one place we asked about a restaurant, a toilet, and they said, "Oh, the restaurant just down the road has one." And we went there and I asked them if we could use it. And they said, "Sure." And while Jasmine and Sima were gone, I was talking with them and they said, "You know, we never say no to somebody coming to use a toilet. The only time we say no is when somebody walks in, like they own the place and they have the right to just barge in and go to the toilet. So that's when they say, okay, you have to pay." But he's like, if people ask and they're polite, we always say yes, especially if they have this French Canadian accent that they love so much in Paris.
I don't say that like cafes and restaurants should allow non-customers to go use their bathroom. Obviously their bathrooms are made for customers, but we would have not used the cafe or restaurant's bathroom if public bathrooms were available.
Right.
Problem is like public bathrooms are not available, so you have to go to, like in Canada, like when we go out, we never need to go to a cafe or restaurant to use the bathroom because there's
bathroom everywhere.
Bathroom everywhere. There are public bathrooms. Even KFC, like you would buy food from KFC or McDonald's, you could still not use their bathroom for free. Even if you
they
purchased
didn't have, like,
food.
A code or
no, you still had to pay. I remember I paid €1.50 to go to McDonald's bathroom.
Anyways, that was a big challenge. Food was a little bit of a challenge, only in the sense that we kind of got tired of eating, you know, street food, restaurants and stuff. And when we finally reached Ghent, towards the end of the trip, we had a hotel that had a whole kitchenette and everything, and we immediately went to the grocery store, bought a bunch of food, and cooked up a really nice meal. And Jasmine was happy. She had rice, she had chicken, she had just normal food.
Yeah.
Less all the sauces and spices.
The food wasn't a big challenge, but it wasn't definitely the kind of food that we always, like, we are very used to home meal, and eating out every day wasn't easy. Chris and I, we both like spicy food, so we had to make sure that like we don't stop somewhere.
Very first day of cycling, we got to the Bray Dunes in northern France. And we walked for almost an hour looking at places on the street, and nothing we saw, we actually felt like eating. We're like, I don't feel like that. Yeah. And then Seema would see something. She's like, how about this? I'm like, I don't know. I don't feel like it. And then I'd see something. Yeah. And finally we settled on big giant hot dog for Jasmine and burgers for us. And that was it. But yeah. Talking about the route, first day, we rode from the Dunkirk port, which is about 10 kilometers before Dunkirk. And we cycled all the way to the Bray Dunes, which was about 35 kilometers total that day. And actually, it was quite interesting as we cycled towards Dunkirk. And I learned more about this on the bus from the airplane to the terminal in Canada. But the huge, huge, they call it the jungle or refugee jungle, huge refugee camp right on the border, right on the edge of the ocean or the straits there, of people trying to get over to England or Great Britain, I should say. And what I heard was it used to be really big in Calais, and that got broken down by the government, and now it's kind of spread out into smaller ones. Well, Dunkirk still has quite a big one, and we didn't know what we were seeing at first. We saw some tents in the woods. I'm like, oh, Seema, look, people camping. And then we're cycling, and it's just more and more tents, and like very permanent tents with like big tarps and like mod tents and all kinds of structures. And then you start to notice that, oh, yeah, none of these people are Western Europeans, white. They're all from Middle East, Africa, maybe even Asians. I don't know. But and more and more and more people. And, you know, even then you start to see some clearings and you see people lined up for food from maybe an NGO or not-for-profit or something. It was quite a hard sight, you know. It was like, as a first impression, of being in Europe, and you're like, what is going on here? And then as you learn more and you realize, you know, this is their last hope. They've been denied by the EU and they got to get to Great Britain to have any chance at, you know, avoiding this issues back home and maybe find safety. And it was crazy. But that was quite the shocker for sure.
Yeah. And then we went to a restaurant in Belgium. If you remember, the lady said that that was one of the
day two of riding.
That they get on those illegal boats, like hoping they get to Great
Zodiacs
Britain.
Type thing.
Then many of those boats sink on the way to Great Britain.
And then what we heard too was that for a while, France had the policy that as soon as people were in a boat, they were no longer their problem. So they would just let them go. And then maybe they'd sink on the way to London or England, or maybe they would get stopped in England, or maybe they'd get there. But apparently then the British government was complaining to them that they're not doing enough. So word is that they're now slashing the boats. So they come up in their own Zodiacs and they just slash them so they sink. I'm assuming they do this while it's closer to shore. And then people have to try to swim back to shore for survival, or they get picked up by the police and the Zodiac, the Coast Guard there, and get deported. I'm not sure. But yeah, quite a awful.
Awful scene to see.
Or, yeah, and but, for the people have to experience, you know, try to find safety.
Yeah.
But, you know, we cycled the Bray Dunes and not much past Dunkirk is all of a sudden it's just the whole expanse is just sand dunes and beaches as far as you can see. Like, we literally rode to Bray Dunes. And then for another 3 days, I think, and all we ever saw was big dunes and beaches and amazing. Like, once you hit Netherlands too, the dunes had paths on them paved. Phenomenal infrastructure. What a view. Any stories about our travels? I guess day one, we went to Bray Dunes. Then we left and we crossed into Belgium and we forgot to get a hotel, or I forgot to get a hotel.
Oh, from Dunkirk? Yeah. So we stayed in Dunkirk one night.
Bray Dunes.
Grey Dunes.
It was not Dunkirk.
Oh, was it? Okay. And then the next day we were about to check out and Chris went to his phone to check where our hotel is in Bruges in Belgium. And he found out that he actually forgotten to book a hotel.
I probably had looked at places and then just never confirmed with someone.
And it was Saturday, and we're going to a very, very touristy town in Belgium in August. And so we checked out. We went to the beach. Jasmine was playing in the sand, and we were just looking for hotels in Booking.com, Agoda, all those things. And it would show one room left, and we are going to book it, and it says, oh, no more available.
Or something.
And then we check again. The prices are gone up. We try to book, and it says, no more available. So we got to a point that the only hotels that were available were, like, starting from $700, and we were not going to stay one night only. Late.
And we literally were just in play hotels for sleeping. Like,
yeah, that's it.
We'd arrive in the evenings,
we're not
going
to spend $700 to sleep in a hotel only. And so we found a hotel closer to Bruges.
Blankenberg.
And it had 5 twin beds. That was their only room that was available.
They twins? I think they were just, yeah, like
twin
small
bed, single bed. Yeah. A twin is single on that side.
Yeah, that's right. You're right. Yeah, yeah.
And it was an interesting hotel.
And it was still the most expensive hotel on our whole trip.
Yeah,
it was $300 for that night, or $300-something.
And it was a very, very average hotel, too. And their breakfast, we paid, I don't know, €17 per person. Their breakfast was very average, too. But and then we got, we went to the Bruges.
We actually took a train to Bruges. Yeah, it was about 18 kilometers away. But since we're trying to manage and keep our daily rides reasonable, we decided to pay for a train. And I think it cost us like €12 or €15 for the three of us to get to Bruges. And then we spent 3.5-4 hours walking around Bruges. We actually put the bikes in a bike garage, put all the bags in the lockers, and just kind of did it by foot. In hindsight, we could have rode through Bruges and experienced
it. Yeah, but it's very busy too. It's not easy. Yeah. Like when you go to touristy towns, it's not easy to ride your bike.
Mm-hmm.
We wouldn't have
seen the same places, yeah, you know, like the little bridges and the little cafes.
You can go inside places and just leave your bike with the bags. You probably can. I think Netherlands and Belgium was very safe. But I had my work laptop in my Telfin bag, so I didn't feel comfortable just leaving my bike out, even locked with the laptop.
And I do have to add the having folding bikes that have suspension, pretty awesome, because some of those old cobbled streets were rough, man. Some of them, the old ones were, bone jarring.
Yeah.
So we spent a few hours walking around Bruges, doing some sightseeing. I think we had a beer in the big square in the market. Our first real Belgian beer, I think, at that point.
Was it the first one? I don't know.
Yeah.
Had a flavored beer, but it was very good.
Yeah, I think maybe it was a Le Chouf Cherry at the time. That was, I think.
It was a Le Chouf Cherry.
And which she turned out to really love. And then from there, I actually met somebody while Seema was changing into bike clothes, because we were going to cycle to Middelburg. And the guy started telling me about this town called Damme, D-A-M-M-E, about 10 kilometers from Bruges, which he said is, you know, very much like Bruges, old squares, old churches, and but much less touristy. And we went there, and it was phenomenal.
Yeah,
we climbed a 43-meter tower at the church that was a viewpoint, a tower to watch for enemies and stuff in 1330 A.D. Which is pretty wild. And it was really sketchy to climb up, but Jasmine did it all on her own, and she had no qualms about it. She was actually upset when we tried to carry her.
Yeah, she was very happy. She likes challenges. So she was very happy climbing up. Mm-hmm. And the ladder, too. So it wasn't just the stairs.
Yeah,
she
so it was like your old style, like, you know, circular stairs like a castle would have. And then at the top of the tower, it was like three sets of very steep stairs / kind of ladder, like a ladder with more of a step on them than stairs. But Yeah, she climbed it all. She refused help, and I just stayed right behind her, hoping to catch her if something happens.
Nothing happened.
And yeah, and the whole story of Middleburg, it was I had booked that as one of the first hotels. I had figured, oh, it's about 50 kilometers from Bruges. I definitely want to stay in Bruges. This is good distance. Found a relatively affordable hotel, booked it. And then when we were in London, I was walking with Wayne, my old principal, and I told him we were going to go to Middleburg. And he says, well, you know, Jasmine's daughter, Jordy, lives there. And Jasmine is one of our very best friends who we named our daughter after. And so Seema quickly got in touch and we found out that Jordy was returning from South Africa just a few days before, and she was leaving the day after we were going to be there, and it was perfect. We met up, we had beer with this adult. And the last time we saw her, she was 12 or turning 13.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was amazing.
Yeah, Middelburg was a little nice little town in Netherlands, too. They have a very nice downtown. Our hotel was interesting there, too.
That was awful.
It was the room was very nice.
Yeah, the room was amazing.
What was it called? Hotel in Middelburg.
Not off the top of my head.
But it had like very, very narrow stairs.
My God, it felt like the castle.
I would say like if you're bikepacking and you're booking hotel, when you're booking it in your notes, there's like special notes that you can book. Always say like, give me ground floor. I realize in Europe when you say first floor is actually one floor above ground
floor. It's our second floor. Yeah,
so in Canada, first floor is ground floor. So make sure that you say you want room in ground floor, because
almost and say I'm traveling by bike, or I'm traveling with a baby, or it's chariot, strollers.
We never had any hotel room that was ground floor. Mm-hmm. Everything we had to either take the
elevator
or the stairs. And this hotel in Middelburg was in the top
floor. This was the worst
floor.
One by far of everything. Yeah.
And the stairs were very narrow, but the room was nice. Room, Bruno. I remember.
Hotel Bruno. Beautiful room, though.
Yeah.
Amazing shower. Mm. Huge bed. Like, yeah, just really nice. But yeah, just that one big downside. So from there, yeah, we cycled to Middelburg and it was phenomenal. You know, after Dame, we made our way back towards the coast. Then we were riding the dunes. Then we had to cross. Oh, we had to take a ferry. That was a ferry, I think.
We took the ferry to get to Middelburg.
To the town near Middelburg, 5 kilometers or 7 kilometers from Middelburg. And then we cycled up to the capital of that area, that province. And it was really, really good. From there, actually, from Middelburg the next day, we couldn't find a hotel that was kind of in the middle distance of getting to The Hague or Den Haag. We found one that was 80 kilometers away. So I had the idea to check with the bus. So we rode to where the bus would come by. We waited for a bus. And then I asked the driver, like, can we take bikes on these buses if we're trying to go to whatever, Renneke, I think was the name of the town. And he said, yeah, no problem. So I was like, he's like, if it's folding bike, it's even better. So otherwise you had to take the wheels off, turn the handlebars maybe. And so we did. Came back after a breakfast and a little ride around town and took the bus for 40 kilometers to Renneke, I think it's called. No, it's not called that. But anyways, whatever it is. And then we cycled our 40 kilometers to our hotel in Brielle, the little town of Brielle, which was absolutely stunning. What a beautiful little town.
Yeah,
definitely an unexpected highlight.
That hotel, I think, our room was in the ground floor.
Oh, it was.
It was on the other side of the building.
We had to go through like five doors.
Oh man, that was really, really difficult.
It was a big hotel.
It was a very big hotel,
and they didn't look thrilled that I wanted to have bikes, so I had to fold them up and I carried them through all these doors and all the way to our room. At least on the way in. On the way out, we just
really had any problem with any of the hotels saying that we can't take our.
I think Paris was the closest we had to issues.
That guy
we can get
to
that later.
Yeah.
So Brielle was really lovely. Like even riding out of that town to make our way towards the Hague was phenomenal.
Yeah.
Just a beautiful ride. And then we spent 3 days in the Hague, which was or 2 full days and a half kind of thing. And hanging out with Mosgan and Ali and We went to Amsterdam. We did a day in The Hague itself.
To Amsterdam,
Yeah, it was really, really great.
Yep. Den Haag was really beautiful. Amsterdam was nice. It was too touristy.
I
like the rest of the Netherlands more than Amsterdam. Like, I really like Brielle, Breda, Den Haag more than Amsterdam. But Amsterdam's
beautiful. And if you're going to Amsterdam to see the red light district, it is not what it used to be. I was there in 2007, and I remember it was just like this maze of red lights at night. And we were there this time, and, you know, Sima was like, I want to see this. But still, like, even people there said, yeah, it's not what it used to be. You know, it's very small. And, but I mean, it was cool to see it, but
we took
definitely a different
cruise.
We did the canal cruise.
Which is, I recommend to people doing that. I think it's like 15, 16 euro. It's cheaper if you buy it online than on the spot. And it takes you, it's a 75 minutes cruise ride, boat ride. And the canals are very beautiful. So that was a good.
Yeah, and lots of good history if you listen to it.
Yeah, but I didn't listen to audio. Chris usually does that.
I like those history things. Yeah, I just tell her after. And then leaving The Hague or Den Haag, we decided to take a train to Dordrecht, which is about 50 kilometers away. And so that we could spend an extra day in Antwerp. And so we got there and then we took, then we rode our bikes to Breda, which was also a really cool city with an old castle, which is actually used by the Belgian Air Force as a training area. So that's where they have their school. And then they have their airports nearby and they fly fighter jets and stuff around there. So it's pretty cool. There was a moat. There was all the good things you could expect in an old town. Very, very pretty. And there we actually stayed with a warm shower. The only time on the whole trip. It's hard to find a warm showers host when you have two adults and a kid. But Sabine and Kuhn were really, really great. We had such a really nice dinner, a nice dessert. We brought the dessert.
They made this delicious.
She cooked this really delicious food, surprisingly.
Beets pasta.
Yeah, it was like...
it's like a pink, red pasta.
What's that twirly pasta called? I don't know what it's called, but anyways.
Not fettuccine, eh?
I don't know. No.
I don't know.
Anyways, it was a little like a noodle, kind of like penne, but slightly different, and mixed with beets and feta. Really good. And I'm not vegetarian, and I even like
it. And they have this like street just for cyclists that they host warm showers.
Above their garage.
Above their garage. So their bed sheets were like bicycle, and they have like bicycle pictures. And
Everything was bicycle. So
and
sweet.
The walls, they had like this whiteboard that they said, "Welcome, Sima, Jasmine, Chris," with a bicycle that she drew, and she wrote the Wi-Fi password on it. It definitely felt very special.
Yeah, it was definitely gives us room for improvement in our own warm showers hosting game.
Yeah.
So leaving the next morning, you know, after we actually, Sima cooked a beautiful breakfast of Iranian omelet. And so we
Why? Because Kuhn and Sari had been to Iran bikepacking.
They had been there twice bikepacking.
Twice, so I told them that I could cook them an Iranian food.
Yeah, so we did that and we spent, once again, another day of leaving at like 11, 11:30, and we cycled around town a bit. Jasmine played at the park for like an hour. In our usual fashion, it was really late when we left and we knew we had our friend Matt in Antwerp and just messaged him. And I said, yeah, we'll probably get there like near sundown.
Well, I should mention something else. It was related to the previous questions about traveling with kid. Jasmine sleeps in the same bed with us. And so we only booked one room.
Oh, you're going to talk about the hotel rooms.
Yeah, hotel rooms. When you book hotels in Europe and you say it's two adults and one child, the system forces you to book two rooms.
Yeah, so if you put your child and you put their age at three, it wants you to book two rooms. And it'll be like, why would you do that? That doesn't make sense.
Yeah, so we always booked one room with a king bed or whatever, and Jasmine sleeps in the same bed with us.
Or queen, or double.
Yeah, so only time that we were given a little bit of attitude about that was in Paris. But other hotels, they never ask us, like, why you have a child, why you only booked one room, because it really doesn't make sense for parents and one child to book tours. But we never really needed another bed. There were a couple of hotels, like the one with five twin beds and the one in Lille, actually, in France. They had a single bed for the child, but Jasmine never slept in it. So for parents that do travel with little kid, I would say book one room, but you can mention in your booking that you have a child, and some of them, they might give you an additional
time. And I did write that in the one for Middleburg. I said, I see that it recommends we rent two rooms, but we have a three-year-old and she sleeps with us. And they said, yeah, that would be silly. Don't rent two rooms. So that's a really good point, Seema. Thank you. Antwerp, you know, there was it was 50K to get to Breda, and then it was 55-ish. And then it was like another 60 to get to Antwerp. It didn't make sense to split it up with a train or anything. Seema was starting to get a cold, or it was the next day, I think.
The next day, yeah.
Yeah, so she was still good. It was just a long day of riding, and but overall it wasn't. There was a section, like we were on the side of a pretty major road between the two countries, and it wasn't the most enjoyable, but as soon as we started approaching Antwerp, we started going through some small neighborhoods and stuff, and it was really, really sweet. Some beautiful houses, beautiful. Yeah. You know, they're big on their shrubs there, their hedges, and they're pretty epic hedges. And from Antwerp to Ghent, it was about 60 kilometers, but Seema was now feeling sick. So we did a 30K ride to one town so we could pass a castle, and then we jumped on a train and cut our time shorter that way. Do you want to talk about Antwerp at all?
Antwerp. The underground.
Oh, there's so much we can talk about. Yeah, first we were meeting up with Matt, my friend.
So we went to Antwerp mainly because we wanted to meet up with Matt, and we stayed two nights again because we wanted to spend more time with Matt. And Matt is our friend from Malaysia that we knew for many years. He took us around, showed us the town. He had another friend from Poland, I think she was. And she was visiting.
Do you remember her name?
Misha, I think.
Something
like that. He was our tour guide for her, his Polish friends and us. And obviously we had a child, so they were patient with us going places. Antwerp is a beautiful town in Belgium. I like Ghent more than
One thing Antwerp, I really liked about Antwerp Brussels, is I yeah. really liked Antwerp's, I forget what the market is called, but they call square? It market, but the main square essentially.
Oh yeah, I forgot what it's called.
And the Groot Market.
Groot Market, yeah.
Just because they had these old merchant guild halls all around the square that would have been, you know, the wool spinners or the whatever shipwrights or the this or the that. And because this was like a main access for trade, these merchant buildings were gorgeous, and they're old, really like 500 years old, 700 years old, whatever they are. And they're like 6-7 stories tall, just huge compared to Ghent, where it wasn't like that. It was all much smaller. So the one in the Antwerp was definitely quite amazing. But Ghent had a lot more old.
And it helped that we knew Matt there, so he knew which parts to go, what the cool places to
visit. Good places to eat.
Yeah. And we had a good time. And we had like a full day there because we stayed two nights in Antwerp. Yeah. So we really had time to visit the town.
And you want to talk about the tunnel?
So we, a second day it's in amazing. Antwerp when we were leaving, obviously we were on our bicycles and we had to cross the river. And the GPS shows us like you have to cross the river. And
it looks like a bridge. Cars, you don't really know what you're looking at.
Cars are going underground tunnel. And we're like, obviously, that's not where we go by bicycle. So we were just like very confused. Like we can't go to the tunnel that cars are going. So and there's no bridges that as far as we can see to cross. What do we do? Then we finally found that there's actually an elevator that goes 31 meter under the water, and there is a underground tunnel for cyclists and pedestrians. So we found the elevator, we got in, and there's like this little screen that shows you how
your depth
how far down the water level you're going. And it shows minus 8, minus 18, minus 20, and like stops at minus 31, and the elevator doors open. They also have like escalator for like pedestrians. And then they, this, it was a huge
And I think
elevator,
the elevator said 18 people or like 18 bicycles or whatever.
It was huge, massive, yeah. Then you go to this tunnel, and it even had speed bumps for cyclists. It was so interesting that like they made that, and it was very old. So it's not something
definitely,
they made
if you want to see it, go into my stories or my posts on Bikepack Adventures Instagram. There's some stuff there on.
And I guess the Gold Gym
day
highlights,
day eight.
Maybe.
Day eight.
So
or seven.
And so we rode our bikes in the tunnel, and then we got to the other side, and there's elevator 31 meter up.
I think
and you're
the big
on the
takeaway
other side
is
of the river.
We were immediately like, I could never imagine any city or the government in Canada investing in something like this for pedestrians, you know, and that river going through Antwerp is pretty wide, not as wide as the Ottawa River, maybe as wide as the Gatineau River. Like, it's still a pretty wide river.
It was
wide, so like,
yeah,
it's pretty impressive. And they just built this massive, I could never imagine that happening in Canada. Pretty wild.
Riding bikes in Netherlands and Belgium definitely felt very safe.
I think part of the reason too, though, is that they didn't have many bridges over the river because it's still used for shipping and stuff. So you can't have small bridges.
Yeah,
it'd be massive bridges to go. The size of the bridge to go over that river so that ships could go under it would be insane. So they have to do tunnels.
Yep. In Netherlands, we stopped even wearing our helmets because the bike passes are very safe. They're far from the road. And like in Canada, I think we have a very good bike infrastructure, at least where we live. But it's not like, as we said, it's not made for
commuting as
day-to-day
much.
Living. Not, yeah. But there, like, it felt very safe. And very comfortable. It was like the whole country is infrastructure is made for cyclists. I felt like,
and they're educated
first,
for it too.
Human and then cars. Yeah.
Yeah. And the education is obviously there. So cars give space. You know, a lot of the roads were so narrow that sometimes a car would just have to stop so you could kind of ride by them.
Yeah.
And they would just stop and wait for you to go past.
Yeah.
That I feel like it would never happen in Canada. Like they would just be honking at you. And so very different mindset. And also quite often the bike path along the side of the road was elevated from the road. So there was kind of not a flat curb, like not a vertical curb, but it was kind of elevated, curving upwards. And then the pedestrian walking area was elevated from that. So everybody had their spot. It was very clearly indicated especially in the Netherlands, the bicycle paths were often red, like a red pavement, anytime you were near car infrastructure. So that if it was red, cars knew that bikes had priority. And if you're at a four-way intersection and let's say the main throughway, the bicycle path would be red. So cars coming from any other direction, from the left or the right, would know they have to give way to bikes. But then the bicycle path for the lesser used road, it would be your normal gray asphalt color. And so that bikes knew they had to give way to cars. And it works so well and so phenomenally well.
Can I talk about the app?
Yeah, so another really, really cool thing is that some of the bigger intersections, they would actually have crosswalks as well. So you'd have to stop and wait, even though it was red and you knew that you kind of had it right away, but you also had this thing telling you to stop. So you had to stop. Hey, it's me. My throat is dry. You could actually download an app if I believe you have to be Dutch or have a residence number. You could download the app that as you approach the light, it would detect it over Bluetooth or whatever, and it would change within 5 seconds so that you could continue without having to stop. But if you didn't have the app like us, you'd have to stop and push the button and wait maybe 15 seconds. It wasn't long. It was never long. So pretty amazing.
It's very cool.
I have water. I can stop coughing now. Good water. H2O is good. Yeah, I think my biggest thing was Netherlands just had such an amazing cycling infrastructure. Even roundabouts, bikes had priority on all the crossings. Do you want to add to that?
Sightings and experience? Yeah, beside the bike infrastructure, we passed like very cool canals with weeping willows close to them. Just like very beautiful, very, very beautiful. And just like canals, you just go. And it's just no roads for cars. So you would have not experienced it if you were on bicycle. In Netherlands, like the wind was always a challenge, but it's so beautiful. Like, I think I got used to it and I stopped thinking about the wind.
And I do feel like you always had a headwind.
Yeah.
It's so true. Carl was right.
Yeah. And even little towns had something to see. Like there's a castle, there's a old wall or like something to see.
Pause for a second.
Drink more water.
I'll have another sip of water here.
Are you recording?
That's okay. There was always something really nice to see. And for the most part, every little town we went through had something nice where Jasmine could play. With the exception of the day we were making our way to Breda, we were going through some really small villages and it was really, we couldn't find anything for fun for Jasmine. So that was, we did find the worst splash pad ever.
Yeah, it was a fountain, actually, I think. Splash pad, yeah, slash fountain. But she still had fun.
Yeah, playing. She played in it for a bit.
Yeah.
And we had a beer.
Yeah, it was right next to an Asian restaurant.
Yeah.
But most cities, like, they all have, like, a market squares, splash pad, grocery stores everywhere, very accessible, so we could stop by stuff for Jasmine.
Yeah, what was the big one we went to all the time?
Albert Heijn.
I don't know. It's like a big grocery chain, I guess.
Yeah.
Fresh juice was amazing.
Fresh juice. Yeah,
they had machines full of oranges, and you just push the button and it starts filling your bottle.
And the local food was very, very good too. It is close to what we eat in Canada, so it wasn't like a big surprise. We had fish and chips in London.
Very expensive fish and chips in London.
Yeah, £22 and a half, I think.
It's like $40.
And then we had gourmet fish in Belgium.
I think it was Netherlands, actually. Yeah. It was after we left Middelburg.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
When we got off the bus, Jasmine played, and then we found an
Iranian restaurant in Belgium. We also went to an Iranian restaurant in Amsterdam.
In Netherlands. Oh, that was in Belgium.
Then we found an Iranian restaurant called Saffron in Belgium.
I think it was either Belgium or it was Netherlands. It was maybe, I forget what side of the border on it was on. But, it was Belgium
for
sure.
It was
before Bruges.
Blankenberg.
Blankenberg. Anyways, yeah, Seema was saying how like tired she was of, like, we were going through this huge, huge outdoor market. And she was like, oh, I'm just so tired of hamburgers and stuff. Like, maybe we can find something else. And then I see the sign says Saffron. I was like, Seema, this has to be Persian food.
Yeah.
And sure enough, it was. And what about interactions with locals and cyclists and stuff?
We definitely saw so many cyclists. Bike tours too. Like, we met a family from Germany. They were going up, like, opposite our path.
Yeah, here across.
And they had a son older than Jasmine. I think 8 or 9 years.
He was 4.
No, he wasn't.
Seema, his bike was tiny. He was just
He
was like 4 years
that
old.
He was older.
You're talking about a different place. First, no, the one with the chariot was not 8. It was 4 years old, Seema. He was just a little.
He was much bigger than Jasmine.
Okay, he was bigger because he was a boy, but anyways, he was young.
He had his own bicycle and a chariot.
And they had little hooks on it that they could hang his bike from.
But locals, our warm shower host, Sabine and Kuhn, they were very cool. And it was very nice of them to host us, cook dinner for us, give us their beautiful warm shower suite to stay. And we just had very good conversation together, especially because they traveled to Iran twice. Uh-huh. And they had printed their pictures for each of their trips.
Oh, yeah, they had really nice trip books.
Yeah, so they gave their Iran books to me for 2014 and 18, I think. They've been to Iran. It just felt very good to see, Dutch people. Oh, yeah, they let me look at it, yeah, definitely. Felt good to see Dutch people going back to my home country and appreciate it. And they even had a little tile that they bought from Iran.
Yeah.
And they had it as a decoration in their house. And it looks so beautiful. Sometimes, me as an Iranian, I don't have such thing in my home. But
we have some tiles that we have as coasters.
Yeah, but theirs was more fun.
Yeah.
But it just felt very good to talk to people who appreciate history and been to the country I'm born twice.
Yeah. And we also had a really interesting interaction with some bike tours we met, or bike packers. We ran into this older couple, probably in their late 50s, early 60s.
Yeah.
His wife was on an e-gravel bike, e-bike anyways, a specialized S-Works electric bike. And the husband was on also a gravel bike, S-Works, really nice bikes. And they had a irreparable flat. So we stopped, tried to help them, but luckily a local came around after about 30 minutes.
An hour, I think.
40 minutes, 40 five, minutes. An hour, whatever. But it was amazing. It was the first day of their trip and, here we'd been so lucky, no problems. And they were on day one and they had a blowout that was so bad. And, but luckily it's only their day one. So it's, I'm sure they could have got home if they need to make the repairs and carry on the next day, but they're going to cycle all the way to Italy, right? Yeah. And, so that was really, really neat. And we had a good conversation.
We didn't see many bike tourists with kids. Jasmine's age?
No.
We definitely saw a lot of cyclists with
kids. I was going to say, the hard part is you saw so many cyclists. And they have panniers because they're often just commuting to work or whatever.
Bike tours, they do look like they're touring.
True.
So we didn't see so many, but it was just very beautiful to see people cycling with their kids, with going to the beach and carry their beach stuff. And their bicycle, their dogs, they had cargo bikes for their dogs.
Yeah, the trailers, a lot of dog trailers.
All their people had e-bikes, but they still ride. It was just very, very interesting. We are so used to driving cars in North America.
Everywhere.
And you see a country that everybody is riding a bike, regardless of your age, your gender, everyone rides a bike.
Even with this insane amount of people riding bikes, Kuhn actually worked in civil engineering and to develop projects to get more people on bikes and improving / fixing or changing infrastructure in small towns or towns that are developing that are growing so that they can accommodate the right amount of cars, but also encourage people to ride bikes to make it efficient. And it was really, really cool to see how much they push to get more people on bikes. Cause they said, there's still a lot of people driving. And I was thinking but look at all the people on bikes. I had a thing here about unexpected detours and serendipitous moments. I guess there was a lot of little detours that kind of happened naturally. I plotted a route on Ride with GPS, but it was meant to be very flexible. And there's quite a few times where we would just end up searching when we went to Dame, popped it up on my phone on Google Maps with bicycle route, and it took us a slightly different route, and then from that point on that day we were on just a different route. We weren't following the GPS or Ride with GPS, and I didn't care. There's nothing to say that the Ride with GPS route I plotted was the better route. Who knows, Probably if I rode there a lot, I could have found out, or if I messaged more people, but planning this all, you know, 10 days before the trip, I just plotted something to have a general idea of distances. And then from there it was going to be a little bit more winging it. I think you already talked about some advice. You know, you talked about getting out on rides with the kids first, getting them used to it. Any other advice, things that you would do differently next time, or tips for first time bike tours?
With kids?
Presumably.
Something that I haven't mentioned. Not really. I would repeat, like do little rides with the kids, teach them how to play on their own. Try to not give them tablet or phones to watch cartoon, because I think you're taking the experience away from them. But make a lot of breaks, stops, making sure that they're like experiencing it and having fun too. Like show them, we stopped to show Jasmine cows, ships,
and llamas, alpacas, even wallaby, I think. Yeah. It was like a miniature kangaroo. I think that's called a wallaby.
Don't worry too much about routines and sleep schedule. And we came back and she was jet lagged for a few days and she's back to her routine. Don't worry about, like, what if this happens?
That we were all jet lagged. Like, we were all awake at 3 a.m.
Yeah, so which is normal. Like, they follow their routine or not. Yeah. When you travel, they are always jet lagged.
I think a general rule of thumb, I would almost guess, is whatever you think it would take to ride that 50 or 60 kilometers, at least double it. Maybe even, probably not triple, but like 2.5 times longer if you got a little kid. You know, because it's probably 2 times longer with bags, or almost twice as long with bags. And then when you get a kid, you can just double that again. So, yeah.
Yeah, a few days ago, we went for a ride around our home for 18 kilometers.
And we were out for like less than an hour.
Yeah, and then I told Chris, so like 18 kilometers when we were bike to packing, it felt like it took forever because we kept stopping. Jasmine needs to go to the toilet. Jasmine's tired. We have to take a break, or we have to eat. And we had weight. We had headwind.
And we should add that, like, it wasn't easy traveling with a kid. Like, Jasmine, she would get really cranky about the cover of the chariot. So sometimes she wanted it closed all the way down and it would be really hot. So we were arguing with her to, like, leave it open so she can get air. And then she wouldn't let us zip off the side windows because this is a change. And she was being cranky. And we're like, well, you can't have it down. So then we got a screaming kid who's upset. Other times there's like a little sunshade piece on it. And she didn't want that down. Or she wanted it down, but not with the tinted visor section that flaps down. And so we're trying to find solutions. And it's like every 100 meters we have to stop. So I just get the bike up to speed. And then I can hear her saying, Baba, stop, and I have to stop. And then we try to figure it out.
Oh, that's cute.
And, man, like, by then my legs were just aching because, but it just adds to the time. So, yeah, double, maybe triple the time that it would normally take.
Yeah, for sure. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Anyways, that was, I don't know if there's too much more I would say differently or add on. Emotionally, it was a really good trip, I think, as a family. It was such a good experience to grow closer and just experience something together, all of us kind of all experiencing the same thing at the same time, you know? So, yeah.
What do you think? I think for Jasmine, it was definitely something she would remember because she's at the age that she remembers she got on an airplane, bus, train, boat, bicycle. She was so happy.
Oh, the two-story bus, the double-decker.
In London. And she, like, we have done other bike tours with Jasmine. Like, we did one Petit Terrain du Nord when she was six months old.
Yeah.
200 kilometers, but she doesn't remember. She looks at pictures, and that's how she remembers. But this time, like, she was old enough to remember. And think these are important for kids to, I wish I had this opportunity to do this kind of adventure with my parents, but I didn't. And I really love that Jasmine, like one day she would say, oh, I did all this. I went to Netherlands first time on bicycle with my parents.
And I think this is something she, maybe this is something, because I grew up with my dad having like small airplanes. And so we traveled as a family, you know, from the age of 3, 4, 5-ish, I think, is when he first got an airplane. I forget, somewhere around between the age of 3 and 5. So we did a lot of trips when I was young, and I remember aspects of it. And, you know, I don't forget how much it sucked as well, because being in an airplane is noisy and it's slow. And I mean, it's slow, it's fast, but it's, you're not experiencing the world. You're just in the sky going through clouds, you know? Where on the bike, I think, is so much more involved in the environment around you. And but this is something I got from my family that I'm passing on to Jasmine in terms of travel. I would add, there was one thing I would do differently, and it's probably in this trip, I would have liked to bring full-size bikes. I mentioned it earlier. But it wasn't the end of the world, really. It's just, it would have been comfortable and fun.
I wish there were, like, such a foldable chariots, because at some places it was really hard to, we used the chariot as a stroller too when we were riding, and it's very bulky, and especially if you're in a busy areas, it's difficult when everybody is on like smaller strollers, then you have this like big chariot. I wish like we had like foldable chariots that like you could wear. Could take something smaller and less bulky, I would have, but I don't know if there are such gear out in the market or not.
Yeah, I'm not sure if there is anything that's really fits that profile. Anyways, yeah, that was definitely one of the challenges, because that thing is huge. And if you go in a restaurant, all of a sudden you're taking a ton of space to put this big ass stroller, but c'est la vie, we managed. I guess final thoughts, I'd say if this is something that interests you, you know, even with a young kid, it's a lot of fun, and you get to kind of experience the world through their eyes, and don't shy away from it, like out of fear that it's too hard, you know, do some little earlier adventures, overnighters, camping in your backyard, things like that. And then just go for it.
Yep. Do a day trip. Like leave in the morning, pack a light lunch and go to a town nearby and then come back. Like start with that. And then if your kid is comfortable, do like maybe an overnighter, go to a campsite. Don't do wild camping. So there's like easy access to bathroom, shower, and maybe a playground. And the younger you start those kids to train them about things like that, it's easier. I feel like it's easier. The kids adjust to change easier when they're younger. Don't wait till they're more teenagers resilient and don't want to do it with you.
Yeah. I do want to apologize for my coughing. My throat has definitely had a long week at school. Probably picked up something from a kid. So by Monday, I'm sure I'll be dead. So sick. But anyways, thank you for joining us on this episode of the Bikepack Adventures podcast. This family tour was really more than just a ride. It was a chance to slow down, connect, and experience the world through the eyes of our child, one pedal stroke at a time. Whether it was navigating cobbled streets, sharing laughs over roadside snacks, or watching my wife take on her first loaded tour with grit and grace, the journey reminded me that adventure doesn't have to be extreme. It just has to be shared. If you're thinking about touring with your family, I hope this episode gave you some practical tips and inspiration to get started. Don't forget to subscribe, leave a review, and share this episode with anybody who's curious about combining parenting and bikepacking. Until next time, keep on pedaling. Thanks for being here, baby. Love you.
Love you too. Bye.
I want to end the show by thanking all my listeners once again for the emails and comments I regularly receive from you. It really helps motivate me and keep me going with this project and to continue sharing people's amazing stories. you have any comments or questions, you can email me at chris@bikepackadventures.ca or go to bikepackadventures.ca and shoot me a message through the contact form. You can also check out the webpage for past podcast episodes, bikepacking routes throughout Canada, blog posts, videos, and touring tips. Lastly, I'd like to once again thank all the individuals and companies that are supporting the podcast. Head over to bikepackadventures.ca/partners for some amazing deals. If you're enjoying the show and would like to become a supporting member, head over to www.patreon.com/bikepackadventures to sign up. Patreons get to enjoy early access and ad-free podcast episodes. You can also support the show by sending a one-time donation through PayPal. This money all goes back into the podcast, helping me to cover the costs associated with running the show, buy new equipment when necessary, and continue to produce the high-quality content that you've become accustomed to. Much appreciated, and keep on pedaling.